In this third lecture, entitled The Dietary Laws, we are going to examine the dietary laws in general in order to look at the meaning behind parts of them. As far as meat, Diane Grunfeld lists seven categories of laws that meat can be divided into. The first category includes permitted and prohibited animals. Number two, prohibited parts of permitted animals. Number three, circumstances under which a permitted animal becomes prohibited. Number four involves shechita, slaughtering. Number five, prohibited food combinations. Number six, proportions of mixtures with prohibited food. And number seven involves the utensils in which prohibited food was prepared. Our first question will be, why are some animals permitted and others are not? We know that man was originally supposed to be a vegetarian. As it says in Bereishis in 1:29, it says, Vayomer Elokim, Hinei nasati lachem eskol esev zorea zera, asher al pnei kol haaretz, veeskol haetz asher bo peri etz zorea zara, lachem yihia le'achla. So the Torah is very clear in the beginning of Bereishis that man is supposed to only eat vegetation. Now, after the flood, man is allowed to eat meat, as we see from Bereishis 9:3. The Torah tells us, "Kol remes asher hu chai, lochem yehia le'achla, ki yerek esev nasati lochem es kol." So from here we see it's explicitly permitted to eat meat. After the flood, man's nature changes. Before the flood, man, we know, sunk to a very low level of morality. After the flood, man's lifespan is shortened significantly. We know before the flood, people lived hundreds and hundreds of years. It's actually machlokas between Rambam and Ramban. Clearly, we're going like the Ramban over here, that generally men lived a long time. And after the flood, man in general, when I say man, I mean mankind, had this new shortened lifespan. Now, a shorter lifespan pushes the species to regenerate at a faster rate, and it also forces life to become much more concentrated. It is possible that in order for man to adapt to this new fast-paced life, he needed food that would be more vitalizing than vegetation alone, and therefore meat became permissible. However, if man were allowed all meat, he would strengthen the animal side of himself because he is consuming animal substance, and therefore strictures are placed on what he can do. Now, concerning the non-Jewish world, there is one law of kashrus, and this is known as Eiver Min HaChai, eating a limb torn off of an animal. And this is prohibited as well to Jews, so Jews and non-Jews alike have this same rule of kashrus, of the dietary law. So if someone would ask, is a non-Jew obligated to eat kosher? So clearly the answer is no, with this one exception, right? A limb torn from an animal, from a live animal, is prohibited to a non-Jew and Jew alike. And besides for the fact that it is cruel, eating directly from a limb torn from a live animal will, to give the exact quote from Diane Grunfeld, transfer of the vivifying parts of an animal, its instincts and passions, into the system of man's body. Now, the Torah expresses this in Bereishis 9:4 through the following expression. The Torah says, Ach basar binafsho domo lo sochilu. Do not eat meat in which its life blood still runs. So, we understand that not to mean that you're not allowed to eat blood. That is a separate command for a Jew alone. But we understand it to mean that you may not eat from a limb which is torn off of a live animal. And this is sufficient for the task that was set for mankind as a whole. Now, the Jewish nation, on the other hand, serves a special role among mankind, and we therefore have much stricter guidelines. And just in case anyone's listening to this is curious about what that special role is, check out the 19 letters series, and we discussed it there at length. So for us, added to the Isser of Eiver Min HaChai, of eating a limb from a live animal, is also a prohibition for a Jew to consume blood. And this is based on the pasuk in Devarim 12:23, which states, "Rak chazak livilti achol hadam, ki hadam hu hanefesh, v'lo sochal hanefesh im habasar." Be strong and do not eat the blood, since the blood is the life. You may not eat the life with the flesh. Now, blood is something which the Torah describes as being the nefesh, the soul of the animal. This means that all the animalistic drives of the animal and the animal passion are in the blood. When a person consumes the blood, he's inculcating these animal instincts into himself. The rule is that the more docile an animal is, the closer an animal is to the vegetable world, and therefore it is less likely that that animal will place its animalistic instincts into man, and therefore these animals are much more fitting for our consumption, meaning for the consumption of the Jewish people. Just to explain this in more contemporary terms, in English we have a phrase, "You are what you eat," and you can see from this discussion, from this line of thinking, that we're taking that in a very literal way. And I know that there are some people that have difficulty with the idea that what one eats will affect him in any way beyond the physical nutrition involved. And I just want to state that this is not true. Different foods and smells have an effect on a person's disposition. It could affect a person's mood. And anyone who's ever looked up practically any vitamin deficiency, you'll see that it has a direct effect on a person's psychological state of mind. And I'd like to turn your attention to a New York Times article. This comes from June 1st, 2007. And the article is entitled, "In Cajun Country, A Fight to the Finish." So you can look this article up online. This article is about an abhorrent so-called sport known as cockfighting, where they train these massive roosters to fight each other to the death. The birds are even equipped with razor-sharp implements to damage each other more effectively. The tsar, the pain to the animal, must be incredible, and the moral issues are so pressing that in most states, at least when this article was written, I don't know what's happened since, have outlawed this so-called sport. Now, let's see two quotes from this article. It's easily recognizable that this activity has quite an effect on the person who owns the bird. Here's a quote from a Mr. Stewart. He writes, "I was pitting roosters when I was 11, 12 years old. It's a heritage. It's been handed down and handed down. Down in the lower country with all the Cajuns, it's big time. Just the way it's in the rooster's blood, it gets in your blood." Now, is this hyperbolic? Let's see his second quote. It says, "The drama continues." Well, this is the New York Times reporter who's saying this. "The drama continues for about 10 more minutes as Mr. Stewart repeatedly revives the sagging bird by blowing on its head and sucking blood from its beak." A person's activities and what he imbibes and makes as part of his person, what kind of intake he has a direct moral, behavioral, and spiritual effect on himself and those around him. And clearly it's not just based on what you eat, but certainly what a person sees, what a person hears, all these affect him, who he hangs out with, and who he is. Therefore, these ideas of more docile animals introducing less animalistic qualities into man, to me at least, is very compelling. This is actually a good introduction to Rav Hirsch's explanation of the dietary laws. Our body, Rav Hirsch says, carries the soul. It is the instrument through which the soul operates in order to carry out its aims of holiness and moral freedom. Now, if your body is passive and submissive, so it's easier for your soul, conscience, however you want to look at it, to be in control of who you are. Therefore, foods that activate man's body in a derogatory, negative manner must be avoided. Vegetation is therefore the most preferable food for mankind, since it is extremely passive, and in fact, this is the halacha. All plant life is, in fact, permissible for consumption. Now, this is, of course, not discussing any other issues with vegetation, such as bugs, or miser, tevel, truma, whatever it is. There are reasons you would not be able to eat certain vegetation, but not because of the vegetation in and of itself. Of all animals, herbivores are closest to the vegetable world, whereas carnivorous animals are furthest away. Carnivorous animals are all usser, and we would posit, based on what we have been saying, that they are all usser since we do not want their cruel traits to enter into the human being. The animals that both have the two signs of kashrus that tell us that they're kosher, which are chewing their cud and having split hooves, are all herbivores and are generally docile. These animals have tame, we would say plant-like characteristics. Even their two signs of kashrus, the fact that they chew their cud and have split hooves, point to passivity. On the other hand, carnivores display the opposite characteristics. They digest their food very rapidly and actively seek their food. They go out, they hunt. Animals that chew their cud, however, they digest their food over a long period of time and in a much more passive process. Split hooves, they're very good for standing on, but they are poor for fighting with. Forbidden animals, we know, are generally more savage. Now, permitted birds fit the same criteria that we have set out for animals in terms of their characteristics. Birds of prey, singing birds, birds that are very active, and they have a special art when it comes to nest building, all these birds are usser. Not one of the permitted birds is something that we would label as, so to say, a cruel animal. There is an argument if these simanim that we have been discussing, along with others that we have not mentioned that are known by oral tradition, are only to assist us in recognizing animals, or if they are the reason for their permission or prohibition. So Rambam is of the opinion that the simanim are to help us to classify and identify the animals that the Torah is referring to. Ramban, on the other hand, is of the opinion that the simanim are the reason for their permissive or forbidden state. And if you look up the Ramban, you'll see that he really gets into science and philosophy that we don't really use today anymore about the four humors, etc. So I didn't get into any of that. But clearly he holds it's part of the reason that they are either permitted or forbidden. Okay, so this concludes shir number 3. And next time we will examine how the three different methods of interpretation that we discussed already, the ethical, spiritual, and symbolical, how they apply to the laws of kashrus.